Colin Carlson is a double major at the University of Connecticut. He has a 3.9 GPA, and he's just 13 years old. Carlson's college experience has been a lot like any other student's, but now he says he's become a victim of age discrimination. From member station WSHU in Connecticut, Craig Lamolt reports.
Colin Carlson doesn't look like your average college student. He's thin with a mess of red hair, glasses, and braces. And he's wearing a crown he just made out of twigs, decorated with a feather he found. Walking along a lake on UConn's campus in Storrs, Connecticut, he spots some shells in the grass.
They are zebra mussel shells by the looks of it, and they will be going straight into my shell collection.
Carlson started out in a private elementary school and then spent a year in public school. He learned everything much faster than the other students, so he started attending high school online from home. And by the time he was 12, he'd enrolled as a full-time undergraduate at UConn. He's busy in student environmental organizations, including the Eco House dorm, although he still lives at home with his family.
I dread summer break. I mean, it's just, I love working on anything academic. Not being able to work on anything academic when I was in public school was really, really nerve-wracking for me. I'm just going to move a bit. I have a really bad phobia of spiders.
It's a bit weird that he doesn't like spiders. He's studying the environment and evolutionary biology. His research focuses on how species adapt to different environments.
It's kind of fitting. You know, I'm going a different path than most people, and I study how plants and animals can take different paths than they usually do.
He says, until now, the university has mostly treated him like any other student. But that changed when he tried to enroll in a class called African Field Ecology, which involves a summer research trip to South Africa. Carlson says university officials told him he can't take the class because of his age.
I'm just as much risk as anyone else, and I shouldn't be excluded on the basis of a two-digit number.
So he's filed a complaint with the university, as well as a complaint with the Federal Department of Education. He says it's a civil rights issue. Michael Kirk is a spokesman for UConn.
The university isn't able to comment on issues of pending litigation or claims. However, generally speaking, when it comes to study abroad, student safety is and has to be our first concern.
UConn offered Carlson a grant to take part in a study abroad program in Kenya or Tanzania that's not affiliated with the university. Jessica Ophir is Carlson's mother.
If their argument is that it's not safe for a 13-year-old to travel abroad, how is it possibly safer for him to go to Kenya on his own with nobody he knows?
Carlson's mother has offered to go to South Africa with the UConn group. She says she'll sign a form saying the university isn't liable for Carlson's safety since she would be there.
I don't want them to be liable for my child. I want them to educate my child.
Some lawyers say UConn might still be liable if something went wrong in South Africa, even with Carlson's mother there. Carlson's found another research group that's headed to South Africa this summer, and he's working on getting grants to go with them. He says he doesn't like the attention he's getting because of all this.
I don't want to be famous. I don't want to stick out. I want to pursue what I want to pursue without having everybody staring at me and thinking about me. And at this point, I'm just trying to make sure that nothing stands in the way of that.
Experts on profoundly gifted children say these kids regularly overcome the barriers they face by proving themselves to be capable of handling things like going to college. Colin Carlson is looking forward to the day that his age will no longer be a barrier. He says he can't wait to be just another middle-aged biologist. For NPR News, I'm Craig Lamolt in Connecticut.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. The new healthcare law promises to make insurance more affordable. If so, that's good news for 19 to 29-year-olds. Their demographic tends to earn the least amount of money and is least likely to have health insurance. Youth Radio talked to 5 uninsured young people from across the country and asked the question, what's the first thing you'll do when you get health insurance?
My name is Kareem Chadley. I'm 28 years old, and I live in Oakland, California. The first thing that I would do is take care of a finger that I broke about a year ago. It kind of has healed on its own, but it's crooked now. So I would probably try to get that straightened back out and fix the break.
I'm Molly Adams in Chicago, Illinois. I'm 23 years old, and the first thing I will do when I get covered is get this thing in my hip and knee on the right side checked out. When I do too much activity, it's like crunchy sounding sometimes. It hurts.
My name is Javier Cabral. I'm from East Los Angeles. I'm 21 years old. The first thing that I would get checked out if I did have medical insurance, I would take care of some impacted earwax that I have gathered in my right ear. Last time I checked, it was $150 just to get it like first wave rinse, and then for the more in-depth cleaning was, I think, $300. So if I did have medical insurance, I would get that taken care of immediately.
My name is Kayla Slow, and I live in Westboro, Kentucky. I'm 19 years old. The first thing I'll do when I get coverage is get my thyroid checked out. I've been waiting about 2.5 years now to get it checked out. I've had a weight problem since I've been 11 or 12. I went to the doctor when I was 14, and they told me that I needed to get my thyroid checked out, but I didn't have any kind of coverage to go to the hospital or go to the doctor. And my mom, she has overactive thyroid, and she's had to go to the hospital and get radiation for it and all this. They told me that if I didn't get medicine for it, that I would end up like her.
I'm Nathan Haddon, 23 years old, and I'm from Oakland, California. My teeth, you know, I have a great smile, but it's a little dingy right now, so I'm just trying to get my teeth cleaned and see if I have cavities, because I haven't been to the dentist since senior year of high school, which was 6 years ago. So I imagine that I have a few cavities by now, even though I brush every day and floss.
Those voices brought to us by Youth Radio. Unfortunately, Mr. Haddon may be out of luck. There was a big debate about dental insurance. It is included in the bill, but only for children up to 21. We spoke with the American Dental Association, and they told us that the average cost for an adult cleaning is $77, but that varies widely by state.
Seemed a good week for President Obama, at home and abroad, bookended by the landmark health care law and an important new arms control treaty with Russia. The White House routinely scoffs at that kind of week-by-week appraisal of the president's standing. But when Mr. Obama traveled to Iowa this week to celebrate the health care law, there was a new tone, and as NPR's Scott Horsley reports, a not-so-new tune.
So how's that hopey-changey thing working out now? Just weeks after being publicly mocked by Sarah Palin and a seemingly ascendant Republican Party, President Obama is sounding like his old audacious self again. With the improbable success of the health care bill, he can once again talk about Americans' ability to do big things and not sound silly. On Thursday, Mr. Obama took that message back to Iowa, the state that launched his presidential bid, and the place, he says, where change began.
What this struggle has taught us about ourselves and about this country is so much bigger than any one issue, because it's reminded us what so many of us learned all those months ago on a cold January night here in Iowa. And that's the change is never easy, but it's always possible.
To be sure, the healthcare battle featured little of the bipartisan cooperation Mr. Obama campaigned on. Partisan divisions are as deep as ever. But the president does now have some major accomplishments to his credit. And having delivered change, he's again free to talk about hope.
Today, because of what you did, that future looks stronger and more hopeful and brighter than it has in some time. Because of you.
Personally, Mr. Obama is famous for his even keel, whether the political winds are at his back or in his face. But a telling signal of the president's mood came at the end of Thursday's speech, when they cranked up the music in the University of Iowa Fieldhouse. Instead of the old-fashioned John Philip Sousa marches that have accompanied the president since he took office, fans heard Brooks and Dunn, U2, and Bruce Springsteen, a reprise of the soundtrack from Mr. Obama's unlikely campaign. Running the country is harder than running for office, and Mr. Obama warned repeatedly this week there are more tough times ahead. But Americans will face those challenges with new confidence, he said. This is the week the president rediscovered his music.
Looking at the promise of the promised land. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley.
One kid dreams of fame and fortune. One kid helps pay the rent. One could end up going to prison.
This is NPR News. Tomorrow, a two-page letter that might be the sum total of the correspondence between two signature American novelists will be put on public display for the first time at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library in Boston, where the Hemingway collection is kept. A 1946 letter to Ernest Hemingway sent by a young J.D. Salinger. J.D. Salinger died earlier this year at the age of 91, which set off renewed interest in any prose written by a man who wrote one of the most famous novels of all time in The Catcher in the Rye. Tom Putnam, director of the JFK Library, oversees the Hemingway collection. He joins us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. Tom, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Help us set the scene. Ernest Hemingway was in his 40s, maybe the best-known writer in the world then. J.D. Salinger was in his 20s, short story writer who'd had a tough war. How did they even meet in post-war France?
Well, as people know, Hemingway famously liberated the Ritz, and he was there camped out, and a number of people came by to visit him, and obviously Salinger actually took the initiative, and they met there at the Ritz.
Ritz Hotel in Paris.
Exactly.
The letter discloses a sense of humor in J.D. Salinger from almost the first line.
Yes, absolutely. There's an allusion to a farewell to arms. Let me read it. He says, "Dear Papa, I'm writing from a general hospital in Nuremberg. There's a noticeable absence of Catherine Barclay's is all I've got to say."
We might need to explain, of course, Catherine Barclay, the sultry English nurse in A Farewell to Arms. We can assume a psychiatric facility of some kind?
We're not sure, but he says nothing was wrong with me except that I've been in an almost constant state of despondency, and I thought it would be good to talk to somebody sane. Mm-hmm. But then he goes on with a little more humor. "They asked me about my sex life, which couldn't be normaler, gracious, and about my childhood, normal. My mother took me to school till I was 24, but you know New York streets."
Now, Salinger was in the Counterintelligence Corps, which I have subsequently read they were supposed to interrogate former Nazis and I guess nowadays we'd call it denazification.
Exactly, although there's a funny line in the letter about that, too. I mean, he clearly somewhat disillusioned. He says, "There are very few arrests left to be made in our section. We're now picking up children under 10 if their attitudes are snotty. Got to get those old arrest forms up to the Army. Got to fatten up the report."
Tom, you sit on thousands of sheets of paper in the Hemingway collection there at the JFK Library. Is there any record to indicate that Ernest Hemingway wrote a letter back to J.D. Salinger?
No, we double-checked today. He did keep carbons of some of his outgoing correspondence, but that was generally more related to business ventures. So he could have written back and not kept a copy.
So this was kind of a one-sided relationship.
Yes, I mean, he's suggesting in the letter that maybe they might meet in New York, and again, we don't have any record that they did. But there's a lovely last line when he says, "I hope the next time you come to New York that I'll be around, and that if you have time I can see you. The talks I had with you here were the only hopeful minutes of the whole business."
The whole business meaning?
World War II.
Tom Putnam, director of the JFK Library that oversees the Hemingway collection, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, sure. Thank you for having me.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. The Obama administration today announced a plan to dramatically expand its efforts to prevent foreclosures. It would reduce the amount some homeowners owe on their mortgages. The plan also includes a push to help unemployed borrowers. The administration says the program can be paid for out of the $50 billion Congress has already set aside for foreclosure relief. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
The Treasury Department is trying to tackle the problem of homeowners who are underwater. That is, people who owe, say, $50,000 or $100,000 more than their house is worth. Analysts say about one in four U.S. homeowners is stuck in that situation. And those people are much more likely to give up making their payments and just walk away from their homes. And those empty houses keep dragging down the market.
What we're focusing on is the problem of people who are underwater who want to stay in their homes.
That's Assistant Treasury Secretary Michael Barr. He wants lenders to actually forgive big chunks of what some homeowners owe. That way, the homeowners wouldn't be way underwater, their payments would be lower. But there is one catch. They have to keep making those payments for 3 years to get the debt forgiven permanently. That's an incentive for them to keep paying, and that would help the lenders, who often lose much more money in a foreclosure. To help encourage lenders to do this, Barr says the government will pay them up to 21 cents on the dollar for the debt that they forgive.
We think we'll be able to reach more people under this program. We think that we'll be able to reduce the risk of redefault. So these are important changes that will help work better at serving families.
Some economists like the new plan, especially since upwards of 4 million people right now are headed towards foreclosure. Chris Mayer is an economist at Columbia Business School.
The coming foreclosure wave is one of the biggest risks that could push us into a double-dip recession. So I think the government is doing well to put out a program to address that.
Mayer, though, is skeptical that these expanded efforts will be able to prevent as many foreclosures as the administration hopes. He thinks that the industry is just too tangled up to deal with so many loans on a case-by-case basis. He's also a little nervous from a taxpayer's perspective. He worries that under one part of the plan, homeowners would get their loans refinanced and guaranteed by the Federal Housing Administration.
And lenders are going to have a very strong incentive to give the FHA the most at-risk mortgages, the ones that are most likely to default. And so the government is setting itself up for potentially higher costs in the future by guaranteeing some of these particularly risky mortgages.
Another part of the plan that some people take issue with are the provisions for unemployed homeowners. Lou Finfer is with the PICO National Network, a faith-based group that's been pushing the government for more foreclosure help.
It really makes us angry that banks got loans to bail them out, but Main Street unemployed homeowners are getting zero loans to save their homes.
Finfer's group had been hoping the government would offer cheap loans to out-of-work homeowners. Instead, he says this new initiative will have lenders offer a three-month forbearance, where homeowners don't have to pay their full loan amount.
The average length of unemployment is now about 7 months, so a program that helps people for 3 months or so, you know, doesn't go very deep.
Of course, some commentators are already decrying the program as an unnecessary government handout. They question why it's fair for some people to get taxpayer money to pay down their mortgages, while most people won't get it. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Curt Schilling pitched the Boston Red Sox into the 2004 World Series and a state of ecstasy. But his youngest son, Grant, had problems. In a family of three boys and a girl, Grant was different. He wouldn't sit with others, couldn't tie his shoes, he'd have daily meltdowns, he'd develop obsessions. He shrank from his mother's hugs, he couldn't grasp directions. As his father said, he's just not processing. And yet, Grant Schilling knew everything there is about dinosaurs, Legos, and mole rats. He displayed astonishing sensitivity to others. He was maddening and compelling. Finally, Grant Schilling was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, a neurological disorder, which, by the way, a great many brilliant people have had. Curt and Shonda Schilling have written the story of their family's life with Asperger's. It's called The Best Kind of Different, One Family's Journey with Asperger's Syndrome. They join us from New York. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And I want to ask Shonda Schilling most of the questions. But
good. I like it that way.
I have to begin by asking you, what's it like for Curt Schilling to show his face in New York?
We've tried to stay to side streets and back alleys for the most part. Yeah, I'm not a big. I don't go over well here.
Well, thank you very much for braving the streets to come and speak with us, Shonda Schilling. I feel that we need a good working definition of Asperger's syndrome. Could you help us?
I can tell you the signs that Grant has. And how it works in our family and what we've seen. Grant has trouble seeing social cues. He has trouble seeing faces and understanding angry and sad on someone's face. Mm-hmm. He is gets into something that he really likes, and he learns everything that he needs to know about that. And when he speaks, a lot of times he speaks without a filter. So he speaks what we like to call straight from the heart.
Mm. And Mr. Schilling, you say at one point in your family story, he's just not processing anything.
Right. Well, I mean, so to kind of make that a simple exercise in understanding, if you were to tell Grant to go upstairs and brush your teeth, put your pajamas on and go to bed, Grant would go upstairs and brush his teeth and come back downstairs. And then if you told him to go upstairs and put your pajamas on and go to bed, he'd come back downstairs after his pajamas. Multi-step directions are very hard for him to process. You know, that being said, he's incredibly intelligent. It's just the way his brain works. He takes different routes to solutions than other people.
And let me understand something. When Grant announces to you, "I won't eat that," mm-hmm. It's the instinctive reaction of a parent to say, "Yes, you will, young right. man, or you'll eat nothing." But that doesn't have any cut any ice with Grant, I gather.
You know, if I were to say to any of my other kids, "You're not getting up from the table until you finish that," you know, on a typical child, they finish it and they get up from the table. He is locked in on not eating that particular food, and it might be the texture of the food. It might be the color of the food. It wasn't as simple as, "I don't like broccoli and I'm not going to eat it." There was mm-hmm. always something more to it that had to do with sensory issues that I had no idea.
Something you talk about in the book is the fact that, look, baseball players make a good income, and that can be good for a family. But they're away from home for weeks at a time during the season. They have to be kind of single-minded in a very demanding and unforgiving profession. Now, that would place a strain on any couple.
Oh, no question. I mean,
well, but what yeah. the particular strain of a couple confronting this?
Well, so for me, baseball was a 12-month-a-year job. There was a very small window of time after each season when I would try and wind down and relax and recover and get back and start getting ready for the season. But it's not any different than a lot of jobs in the real world. You travel most of the time. You're away from home. The difference is that you're compensated a lot more for doing what I did for a living than most other people are for any profession. But that compensation doesn't come into play when it comes to your children.
We're talking to Kurt and Shonda Schilling, their book, "The Best Kind of Different: One Family's Journey with Asperger's Syndrome." Shonda Schilling, it must have been tempting to say, "I don't care if you are pitching in the seventh game of the World Series. I need help."
But see, I took it as a pride thing, which was the mistake. If I asked for help, then I wasn't a good enough mother. And because Grant wasn't achieving and my other kids were not achieving, they weren't the straight-A students, I really thought that I was a bad mother. And through this process, I've learned that, you know what, I am a good mother. And, you know, there is no perfect child and there is no perfect parents and there is no perfect parenting skills. But if your kids are happy, you know, that's the best gift that you can give your children.
I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that, according to scholarly reports, it's possible that Einstein, Ben Franklin, Napoleon, Lincoln, Harry Truman might have all had Asperger's syndrome.
Well, Steven Spielberg has Asperger's.
Yeah. It's one of the things I think that we both talked about when the diagnosis was handed to us and we started to really understand what it was. Puzzle pieces just kind of fell into place. You know, those temper tantrums in the grocery store, and you used to look at kids and go, you know, geez, will you get a hold of your kid? And the kids you went to school with who were quote-unquote outcasts and different, mm-hmm. A lot of things made sense. Unfortunately, and it's sad to think that we grew up in a generation where those kids were just looked at as unruly as opposed to challenged. Mm.
Would you ever get embarrassed about being embarrassed by a tantrum?
Yes.
Not me.
I can't help but be sensitive to reactions of people around me when I really, you know, I don't have control of the situation. But there's still times, you know, mm-hmm. when he's at a soccer game and he's supposed to be playing goalie and he's twisted himself so far up and here comes the ball and he can't untwist himself. I mean, I am going towards laughing at those situations, but I still get embarrassed.
He twisted himself how?
In the net.
In the net. He was twirling in the net, you know, and at 10 years old, that's not funny. You know, at 10 years old, the kids are playing to win. The parents are there,
yeah.
you know, because they want to win.
The parents are sure playing to win, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and there he is all twisted up in the net, and they score, and the kids are yelling at him. And he says to me, "Can you imagine they were yelling at me for that?" Like, he doesn't get that he just, you know, cost him a goal.
He has his Charlie Brown moments.
If I ever meet him, and I hope I do one day, I would never want to break wind around him.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, and he tells that every chance he gets. But don't ever ask Grant anything honestly either. Yep. Yeah.
I should explain, Grant announces when his parents...
His mother never does.
We fart in public, and Grant makes sure to announce to anybody within earshot that what has just happened.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
And sometimes you do stuff, and you go, oh no, and here it comes. It's just there's no way to hide that. But I think that's the beautiful thing about Grant is if once you set into your mind that nothing he does is out of maliciousness or disrespect, you really appreciate the heart that's inside that little boy.
Well, Kurt and Shonda Schilling, been just a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Shonda and Kurt Schilling, their new book is The Best Kind of Different, One Family's Journey with Asperger's Syndrome.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.